Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Can happiness and well-being improve our health? If so, what can we do to live happy lives? Happiness is our subject today. The medical ramifications a little bit later. But first, what is happiness? The definition is likely to be different, like beauty, depending on the beholder. Is it a standalone quality or a composite of joy, pleasure, and well-being and humor? We'll be learning more about this during the course of our discussion today. A $5 million grant has been awarded to St. Louis University to figure it all out. Joining me in studio to talk about it are Professor Dan Habron. He teaches philosophy at St. Louis University. Tim Bono is assistant dean and lecturer in psychology at Washington University. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We hope you have a happy experience here at St. Louis on the Air. Dan, if I may begin with you, explain, if you would, what you mean by the science of happiness.
So it's really just any kind of research on happiness that that is done like scientific research. So gathering data about happiness. And we use the terms pretty broadly. We don't try to stick to a particular definition of happiness and leave it to researchers to decide what it means. So it's most of the research is probably done by psychologists, but the science of happiness, some of it's done by neuroscientists, economists, anthropologists, sociologists, and other fields.
Have they come up with a definition?
I have. So the defining things business is one of the things that philosophers tend to focus on. And in my own work, I tend to think of happiness as what researchers call emotional well-being, roughly the opposite of anxiety and depression. But some researchers talk about happiness more in terms of life satisfaction, which is more like a judgment about your life as a whole. And there are other definitions out there as well.
Tim, what about you? What would your definition be?
Well, I think that often in psychology, we refer to happiness as being subjective well-being with an important emphasis on the word subjective, that to know how happy somebody is, you can't look at how much money they have in the bank or what size their house is or what kind of car they drive. Rather, it has a lot more to do with the subjective appraisal of the circumstances in their lives. So in general, we think about happiness as the ratio of how much positive emotion an individual is experiencing relative to how much negative emotion they're experiencing, in addition to the extent of life satisfaction that they're experiencing as well.
So it means different things to different people.
Absolutely, yes.
How important is it?
How important is it? Well, it's very important. It's associated with a number of important outcomes. One of the things that we know is that people who are happier tend to do better on performance in terms of their cognitive abilities. When people are happier, before they take a test, they do better on that test. We know that happier people live longer. They get sick less often. People often are pursuing success, and they say, as soon as I'm successful, then I'll be happy. Well, it turns out that there's research to suggest that the opposite is true, that happiness itself precedes those outcomes because happiness gives us the wherewithal to be successful in those domains of life that are important to us.
And Dan, that's one of the things that I've run across in getting ready for this program time and time again, that having money, which a lot of people think will make them happy, isn't a guarantee of that by any stretch.
Absolutely not. There's general agreement that being really poor and not having enough money to make ends meet is very stressful and is associated with less happiness. But there's a lot of variation in different populations, different individuals, and you see that the relationship, depending on how you think of happiness, the relationship gets weaker and weaker as you get higher up the income scale.
Although I've heard someone say, I've been poor and I've been rich and rich is better. But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily happier.
Yeah. So and that's I think most happiness researchers agree that that poverty is a real happiness problem. And it's possible for poor people to be happy. But on average, poor populations tend to experience a lot more stress and tend to be less happy. And so if you want to make people happier, addressing poverty is one way to go about it.
How do we measure it?
This would probably be something Tim knows is in his area, but basically there's lots of different ways to measure it, but most of the research is done just asking people questions originally usually was asking questions like, how happy are you, or how satisfied are you with your life? And research still asks questions like that, especially life satisfaction. But instead of asking so much about happiness, there's more research at breaking it down into more specific things. Like, did you feel sad a lot of the day yesterday, or did you worry a lot? Did you laugh a lot?
Tim, how do you measure?
Yeah, it turns out that is the most common way for us to scientifically gather data on how happy an individual is by simply asking them, for example, on a scale from 1 to 10, how happy are you? And there are a number of reasons why we take that approach. One goes back to what we were talking about a moment ago, which is that it has to do with the subjective component of someone's reaction or appraisal of their life circumstances. But the other reason is because that self-report measure does, in fact, correspond to other hard objective measures we can collect. So, for example, we can ask you how happy you are, but then we can ask your friends or your coworkers or other people who know you well. And it's not very common to find a situation where you have an individual who rates themselves as very happy, but everyone who knows them gives them a lower rating of happiness. That self-report measure also corresponds with cognitive performance tasks. So we can ask you to generate words that are associated with some ambiguous or neutral word, and people who are happier will generate more words that are on the positive side of the emotion continuum. People who are less happy will give more words on the opposite side of that continuum. But I would say that perhaps the most compelling evidence that we have that gives us confidence that a self-report measure is a valid way to measure happiness is that it comes from research done by neuroscientists who have identified regions of the brain that we know to be associated with happiness. In particular, one region that's especially important is called the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that sits immediately behind the forehead. And the ratio of activation on the left side of the prefrontal cortex relative to the right side tends to correspond with happiness. And it also corresponds significantly with an individual self-report of their happiness. So we could go through all of the process of buying that equipment and doing that every time we wanted to measure an individual's happiness, but it turns out that's really expensive. Most scientists can't quite afford that. And because it corresponds reliably with an individual self-report, we have confidence that that is a good way to get a measure of an individual's happiness level.
Dan, you're nodding in affirmation here, but let me ask you, when we're talking about happiness on the one hand, what is the difference between happiness and pleasure and happiness and joy, happiness and humor?
It depends on who you ask. That's what we academics get paid to say.
Uh-huh.
In my view, and what I've argued in my work, is that happiness and pleasure are often confused. And when you think about happiness as a matter of emotional well-being, you might have back pain, and there's a question that you still feel the pain, but there's another question of whether emotionally you let it get to you or get you down. And it's that emotional condition that I think people are most concerned with when they're thinking about, well, I want my children to be happy and healthy. And so joy is one important part of that. Peace of mind, a sense of tranquility, but which needn't mean that you're just sitting under a tree doing nothing and humming, and also a sense of energy or vitality and feeling engaged with your life. It's a complex thing, and there's different aspects to it, and it's not just a matter of, people tend to think happiness is just a fleeting emotion of a smiley face feeling, and there's a lot more to it than that.
You agree with that, Tim?
Yeah, I would. You know, when we talk about happiness, we often will draw a distinction between different kinds of happiness, that there's one kind of happiness that is what we refer to as hedonic well-being, which is more of the pleasure principle. Going out, having a good time, riding a roller coaster, eating an ice cream cone. It's the stuff that feels good in the moment, in the here and now.
But just to interrupt for just a second, isn't all of that happening in the same part of the brain you were just describing?
Yes. So that would lead to activation of that left prefrontal cortex. But in terms of the long-term implications of that, there's another aspect of well-being that we called eudaimonic well-being, which comes from our friends in philosophy, that goes back to Aristotle's idea of eudaimonia, or one's true self, that it's possible to be happy even if we aren't experiencing day-to-day pleasure about something. So you could think about someone like Mother Teresa, who gave up all of her material goods, but she was experiencing a high level of life satisfaction and would probably tell you that she was happy because her life was dedicated to some larger life purpose. Or you could think about a young parent. I think about my older brother, for example. He's got two small kids, and I talk to him on the phone, and he'll tell me that he's stressed and he's anxious and he's worried. There's a lot of negative emotion on a day-to-day basis that a young parent will experience, and yet he'll say that he's happy because he's fulfilling one of his most cherished life goals, which is to have a family.
Dan, if we are not happy, what are we? Sad?
Well, unhappy. Sad. stressed. I think stress is something that I think does not get enough attention in well-being research, and stress makes everything worse, at least chronic stress. And some stress is good, but chronic stress, the kind that gives people heart attacks and shortens their lives and gives them stomach problems and causes them to have trouble sleeping, that corrodes all facets of life. So that's one aspect of it. Also, kind of boredom, listlessness. Depression isn't just sadness. It's also a lack of energy and kind of being psychically disengaged from your life.
But we can't expect to be happy 24/7, can we?
No, and it's healthy. We have all these different emotions for a reason. Sadness and anger and fear are all healthy in their place, and they all have a role. And it would be, you don't want to be happy if something bad has happened to your family. So there's appropriate emotions as well. But in general, people who are happier tend to be doing better. I think of happiness as kind of the core of well-being or flourishing.
And Tim, in a word or two, if we are not happy, what are we?
Well, I think that it's important to acknowledge that our emotions reside on a continuum, and happiness is not necessarily the opposite of unhappiness. So it's possible for us to just sort of be at the zero or neutral point and think about ways that we can push ourselves closer to the happiness end of the continuum.
We have to take a break. We'll do that in just a second or two. But I want to invite listeners, if you'd like to get into this conversation, tell us what makes you happy. We are talking with Professor Dan Habron of St. Louis University and Tim Bono of Washington University. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Dan Habron and Tim Bono. We are talking about happiness. A number of people are calling in, but we have a message here that I'd like to read to you and get a response, given what we've just been talking about. And that is, how can neuroscientists tell that brain activation is due to true happiness and not just by people thinking about or reporting on their mood? Tim, do you want to take that?
So it sounds like the question is, are we actually detecting an increase right. in happiness versus just patterns of neural activation that are associated with positivity? Well, again, we have evidence that particular activation of the brain, that left prefrontal cortex relative to the right prefrontal cortex, is associated with outcomes that we would characterize as happiness. But the other thing is that where our thoughts go are a very important predictor of our overall well-being, and sometimes just thinking about the concept of happiness more generally is one way to induce a positive mood. We've done a number of studies at WashU where, in order to increase an individual's happiness, we will simply have them read a list of words like happiness and joy that are associated with positivity, and exposure to the concept of well-being is one way to provide a modest increase to our overall well-being. So it could be capturing that to an extent.
We have a tweet here I'll read to. It says, the writer writes, "What makes me happy is a good long run in great weather." Weather, exercise. Now, my question is, and you can decide which one will answer it, is this writer truly happy, or is that just a moment or an episode of pleasure? Can that be classified as true happiness?
I'd love to take this one because I was doing that myself this morning in Forest Park. It is absolutely the case that exercise on a regular basis is one of the most robust things that we can do to incorporate into our lives to increase our well-being. And it happens at both levels, both at the state level, that immediate boost of well-being, but also when we incorporate a behavior like that into our everyday routine or every other day, for example, that is another way in the long term to give us a boost to our happiness. And that also, we have evidence from neuroscientists showing that exercise on a regular basis is associated with the release of key neurotransmitters that are essentially the brain's natural feel-good chemical to give us a boost to our happiness and well-being. And in good weather, too, is an additional way to do that.
Dan, your thoughts on that?
Well, my mileage varies because I find running kind of unpleasant, but but I do think that and that's an example of something where with practice and developing skills at something, then it does become very rewarding. But another factor with athletic activity like that is that you can get into a flow state, and we call it being in the zone, where you're just totally absorbed in something. It can be kind of meditative, actually, and that's very strongly associated with lots of other good outcomes.
Meditation?
Well, meditation, too, but that state of flow or being in the zone where you're just really caught up and engaged in what you're doing.
Is there any single thing that all of us could do to ensure our happiness or prolong it?
I'd say that there's a whole battery of things that psychologists have put forward as interventions. And I think that it goes back to the idea of subjective well-being. It's important to try them out to see what works. But I would say that one of the simplest yet most robust ways to increase our happiness is simply through the practice of gratitude. People who take just a couple minutes every couple of days to focus their attention on the good things in their lives have shown to see an increase in their happiness, in their optimism. It also shows a decrease in how often they get sick. So that's one thing that you don't even have to change anything about your life. It's simply shifting attention to those positive things. So gratitude by itself, but exercise, sleep, meditation, flow experiences, those also are very easy and good ways to increase happiness too.
Dan, anything to add to that?
And I would add, I agree with all that. And at a further level of remove, a lot of the things that are beneficial for happiness involve changing your habits, and that can be kind of hard. One thing that can be very helpful is putting yourself in situations or engineering your environment so that it's easy or natural to live in a way and achieve a lifestyle that suits your values and is fulfilling and rewarding for you.
How are we as a country on the happiness scale, would you think? I've heard, for instance, Denmark and some of the Scandinavian countries, the happiness quotient is very, very high, primarily because their lives are pretty much taken care of for them. They know that if they get sick, they're going to be taken care of, things like that.
So this is something where I probably disagree with a lot of my friends in psychology. I think that the measure, when you ask people how happy they are, most Americans, actually the vast majority of Americans, will say they're happy. But it's sort of like being asked if you're, you know, are you intelligent or good looking? And nobody wants to say they're stupid. And nobody wants to say they're unhappy. But that doesn't, the measures actually go up and down with happiness and still actually track the differences in people's happiness. In the United States, I think there's, when you look at different pieces of the puzzle, there's a lot of unhappiness in the United States. There's a lot of, you'll see a lot of loneliness, stress, sleep trouble. So there's, we're not doing terribly, but we could be doing better.
Right. You want to add to that? We have some calls, and I'd like to take some of those to get our audience into the conversation. We'll start with Jeff, who's calling from St. Louis. Jeff, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I don't know to what extent the guests have had a chance to look at the linguistic history, but I'm curious to know that when our Declaration of Independence talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, what did that word mean then?
Interesting question.
I would imagine that it means a lot of the same things that it means today, that it's that experience of feeling good about ourselves and feeling good about our work and having a right to pursue those opportunities that align with our own internal values and standards. Admittedly, that's not something that I have that I've studied. But if you look historically, I mean, even the ancient Greeks were interested in this concept of happiness. And in their writings, too, you kind of have a sense of happiness being living your life according to particular values and seeking out opportunities that align with that.
And the English word happiness comes out of the word for good fortune, good hap. And you find this in many, many languages, actually, that there's a word for good fortune, like what you wish the young couple on their wedding day or when they have a baby, a life of happiness, of good fortune. And what was happening around the time Jefferson wrote is, as far as I can tell, and it is something I'd like to fund other people to study, is that it, we were transitioning to more of a psychological meaning of the word happiness. And I think when he wrote that, I think he meant more what the Greeks had in mind, a good life, rather than just a feeling. But it could be, but it's hard to tell. And other people were using it clearly to mean a good state of mind.
Do you think some people might be predisposed to be happy? We talked before about the people who are poor and under stress and people who are wealthy and presumably also under stress at times. But can that poor person be predisposed to be happy in spite of the condition that their life is in?
We do have evidence that our happiness is partly determined by our genetic predisposition that we get from our parents. And the estimate is that it's about 50% of our overall happiness is from genes. So yes, that would provide a starting point. But the other thing that we know about genetics is that just because we have inherited a particular genetic predisposition, that does not necessarily predestine us to the outcomes or the effects of those genes. So it's a matter of identifying the environmental circumstances that can either trigger the onset or the activation of those genes or not activate them. You can think about something like alcoholism. You might be predisposed for alcoholism, but if you never drink alcohol, then you won't experience the adverse consequences. Same thing with a risk for depression or anything else. It's about aligning that predisposition with the appropriate environment.
That fits right in with one of our callers, I believe. Jackie is calling from North County, and I think this is the perfect point to take her call. Go ahead, or his call, whatever, Jackie. Go ahead.
Yes, I am the total opposite subject of what you're actually talking about. And the scientists have now found out that people like me come this way. A recent article I saw that they did MRIs on 4- and 5-year-olds that had areas where depression is in adults showed up the same in kids. And that the best description I've ever heard of depression is the absence of joy. And I have gone through a miserable life of being totally alone without friends and people doing things to me as an adult that would be beyond your comprehension. And I was diagnosed with ADD in my late 40s and in my late 50s, Asperger's.
Do you have a question, please, Jackie? We're having a time constraint here, and if you have
I apologize.
That's all right.
I'll have to catch you when you're having a show about people like me.
Well, we'd love to have you back, and we'll do that at some point. But let's get some comment from our guests here with regard to this part of the equation. This, and Tim, you're probably the one to take it. This is exactly the other side of the coin.
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that we think about emotions residing on this continuum, that on one side we have those negative emotions, like Jackie is describing, despair, loneliness, anxiety, and on the other side is happiness. And in the middle of that is the zero point. Psychologists take a different approach from going from zero to happy than we do from depression into that neutral state. So for someone, and the fact of the matter is that many people are like this who are suffering from some disorder on that lower end of the continuum, and that requires a completely different set of interventions beyond and separate from what we're talking about today. The good news is that because those are relatively common, anxiety disorders and depression, there's been a lot of research into their nature as well as into the most effective interventions to help people overcome them.
All right. Is there anything you can specify right at this moment that someone who is depressed can do?
If there were only one predictor of overall well-being, or I would say the strongest predictor, it has to do with the strength of an individual's social support network. So I would encourage people as much as they can to get involved in something in the community that would enable them to establish connection, social ties to other people. And if you have the means and the ability to seek out a therapist who can help you, again, these issues are well-researched and there are effective treatments to help people overcome them.
Dan, back to you. Is happiness contagious?
Yes. One of the most interesting things in recent years that's come up in the research is that happiness and many other things we're very, very sensitive to our environment, especially our social environment. And we don't just make choices thinking it through. The people around us, the environment infects the way we think and the way we feel. People who have shifted between living between different cultures, like speaking different languages in different environments, often find that their personalities are kind of different. That's one of the things that got me interested in this work, is my own experience like that. And so one thing that that can be one of the things that can be tricky is in the United States, for instance, the rate of depression is much higher than in some other places and in some parts of the United States. Among Amish communities, rates of depression are much lower. And a lot of that, I think, is the lack of social support. And sometimes finding the right situation where, in essence, the environment will infect you in the right way can be very helpful.
That's Professor Dan Habron of St. Louis University. Also with me in studio is Tim Bono of Washington University. We're talking about happiness. We're going to continue that conversation with another guest from Washington University on the medical ramifications of happiness and well-being. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We've talked about the science of happiness and well-being. Now we turn our attention to the medical benefits. Are there any? Joining me and Professor Habron and Tim Bono to look at that is Dr. Robert Cloninger, Professor of Psychiatry and Genetics at Washington University and Director of the Center for Well-Being there. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
My pleasure.
Are there health benefits to happiness?
Definitely. We could expand a bit the definition of happiness that you've been discussing, because it turns out that well-being is a broader concept and that there's a close relationship between emotional well-being, social well-being, and physical well-being. And these go together hand in hand. And for that reason, I often focus on the term well-being because it includes the body, the thought, and the soul.
Can that be controlled, however, like a doctor would prescribe medicines or treatment of some sort for any kind of illness?
Well, it's not a matter of just prescribing a pill, because, in fact, antidepressants reduce negative emotion, but they're actually not very good at creating life satisfaction or a sense of meaning and purpose.
I wasn't thinking of a pill per se. I was thinking of some of the other things we've talked about. Exercise, for instance. We had a caller a few minutes ago, you may have heard, who clearly is suffering from depression, at least, and that's what she told us. And we're wondering, you know, what could be prescribed, aside from a pill, that might be helpful to someone like this?
Yes, you're right on the right track about the fact that we need to combine many different approaches to the whole person. And physical exercise, developing just an awareness of your body, a meditative-like state, allows the person to feel that the mind and the body and their sense of purpose and meaning all go together in a coherent fashion. And that way, we can grow an awareness of our body, what we hope to create in the future. And so the process of treating depression or anxiety is very much a matter of helping the person to become more aware of who they are now and what they would like to become by cultivating the strengths and the potential that they have within themselves.
What are some of the other health benefits of this well-beingness, if you will, happiness and well-being?
Well, it's interesting that you would say it the way you did, because in a way it points out that we often falsely think of happiness as someone sitting in a yoga position on a beautiful mountaintop or beach. And in fact, what we're talking about is something that has a tremendous impact on the full range of our health, so that heart disease, risk of cancer, the function of the whole body, all the systems of the body are connected, so that we have this false notion that we can be happy but not eat well or not exercise properly. And so well-being really has to do with creating the circumstances that let us live not only a good life, but a healthy life with joy and health and productivity.
Dan and Tim, do you want to get in on this? Is there something you've heard you'd like to comment on?
Well, in terms of, instead of just giving someone a pill to increase their happiness, I think that instead of looking for necessarily a one big thing or a quick fix, often in increasing our happiness involves incorporating small, daily, intentional behavior so that it truly becomes a lifestyle. It's something that Dan mentioned earlier. It's about identifying those strategies that truly can become part of our daily habits and routines. So the things like getting a full night's sleep on a regular basis. I've seen a number of studies showing that exercise on a regular basis can be just as effective and in some cases even more effective than our most common psychiatric medications like Zoloft or Xanax. So incorporating those kinds of behaviors, which you can do on a regular basis, it's those small incremental gains that ultimately will shift an individual toward the happier side of that emotion continuum.
If I could extend that a bit, it's very important to listen to the words that you just heard from Tim, because it's the intention. And we know that lots of doctors tell their patients and public health officials tell the general public to eat well and to get up at the same time in the morning and so on. And people don't do it. And the reason that they don't do it is that they're not really aware of what the feelings and the benefits. And so if you ask yourself, what is it that's meaningful to me? What is it that brings me satisfaction? And then you intentionally work at overcoming the obstacles for that. Then you build a lifestyle that's conscious, that's meaningful, that's healthy, and that's satisfying. And that's why we can never separate any aspect of health, physical, mental, social, spiritual.
Spiritual is something that I know you certainly include in all of your talks and all of the things that you discuss in this area.
Well, that's because meditation and contemplation is the way that we can look within ourselves. And what we're looking at here is not a superficial external support system, but something that we feel inseparably connected to so that we have an intrinsic inner strength and hope and drive that enables us to feel healthy even if things are going wrong at the moment.
You know, and all of you get into this part of the conversation. It was some years ago, the journalist Norman Cousins was diagnosed with cancer. I think this story is well known. And he self-prescribed, and the prescription was laughter. And basically, he sat and watched the Three Stooges or cartoons or whatever and left. And his cancer went into remission. Right. What is this telling us?
There's a strong relationship between positive affect and the health of the immune system. And If you're sad, you actually have an inflammation of your brain. And we can measure that with chemicals in the brain that shows that there's stress that impairs memory. There's effects on the immune system. So the whole body goes into a state of dysfunction when we don't have a sense of the joy of life.
Tim, I imagine this. Go ahead, Dan. You wanted to respond.
I think laughter especially, I have not yet looked very much at the research on laughter, but it seems very plausible that that's can really function to help break us out of ruts in relationships. And the kids are stressed out at school, everybody's intense, and you find occasions every day to laugh together and just joke around. And that And one of the things that Dr. Cloninger's work has really emphasized that has been really beneficial is the importance of looking at the whole picture. And our well-being is a dynamic thing. It's not a static thing. And we have to look at the whole picture. And we get into kind of negative cycles that can be self-reinforcing. We can also get into positive cycles that are reinforcing. And my suspicion, at least, is that laughter would be a really potent tool for that.
Tim, they say that laughter is the best medicine, right?
Yes, and I think that it goes a lot with what Dr. Cloninger was mentioning in terms of when we have the experience of positive emotion, when we're doing things like laughter, our emotions are very closely linked to activity occurring in our brains and the release of certain chemicals in the form of neurotransmitters and hormones that ultimately trickle down and have implications for things like our immune system and our physical well-being as well.
I wonder if go ahead, Doctor.
Well, just if we think about what a laugh is. If we're laughing, we've had not an aha moment, but a ha-ha moment. And that means that we've taken suddenly a shift in perspective. And the flexibility of our mind to shift perspective is the basis for humor. And it also enables us to deepen our insight so that we can form new intentions that have new meaning. And it does break us out of a rut. And so the intentionality, the plasticity, and the capacity to look deep within to see what really is meaningful and good is what enables us to transform our lives, not out of just what we should be doing, but what makes us life worthwhile.
I wonder how far we can take this, though, with regard to well-being, happiness, if you will, in terms of keeping ourselves healthy. I mean, if you can cause cancer to go into remission, I wonder how far we could conceivably go.
Well, the point is that well-being is not a transient state. Mm-hmm. It involves changes in the regulation of the brain and other systems throughout the whole body so that that's reflected in stable changes in personality. Mm-hmm. So growth and well-being is essentially growth in character development. And those changes in character development are what are most predictive of our longevity and at risk for chronic long-term diseases. And this is the thing that's being neglected very much in the healthcare system today. Mm-hmm. We're looking at acute fixes for problems when they're already there. Mm-hmm. And this is the positive psychology approach, positive psychiatry approach, integrative medicine approach, is to look at the whole person to get them to transform their lives, to prevent and cure disease.
You know, coincidentally, a friend, acquaintance of mine yesterday, I had a chat with him. His wife has Alzheimer's, and she has been institutionalized at least temporarily. And he said that she spends all her time watching cartoons. And doing this, he has noticed a marked improvement.
And she can watch the same cartoon over and over and still find it funny because she has a memory problem. But the point is that laughter or positive affect is contagious, and it gets us in a point of view that lets us let go of all the negativity that's very destructive.
Mm. Any comments, gentlemen?
Well, it also goes back to something that we talked about earlier with habits, that the more that we do something, the easier it becomes, and part of that is because it's governed by particular areas of the brain. So, for example, you can look at taxi drivers. There's a classic study done a couple of years ago showing that taxi drivers, comparing them before and after their training, they observed an increase in a region of the brain called the hippocampus that is responsible for spatial memory, because these taxi drivers have to use that region of the brain a lot as they're making their way around the streets of London. Cellists have a larger part of the cortex that is devoted to the areas that correspond with their left fingers compared to their right fingers, because their left fingers are doing a lot more when they're playing the cello, which then enables them to engage in those behaviors more frequently in the future. The same thing can happen when it comes to our thinking cycles. It's important for us to catch ourselves every once in a while when we're at a red light or we're in line at the grocery store to think about where our thoughts are going. Because if we can get ourselves to put a halt on the negative thinking and instead turn our attention to our families or something really positive, positive that we have that's coming up or a funny joke that somebody told us, then we are activating those regions of the brain that are responsible for positive emotion. And therefore, that region of the brain is positioned to interpret and respond to things in a much more positive way in the future. So the more that we use something, the easier it is to engage in that in the future. And the same thing goes for the nature of our thoughts and whether they are positive or negative.
Go ahead, Dr. Clark.
If you think about this kind of advice, you'll see that what you have to do to make that a natural expression of who you are is to think about what are your overriding goals, and don't think of these as just techniques. We found in the well-being coach training program that's run by the Anthropedia Foundation that there are three or four principles and practices that you can carry out in life that really make life much more worthwhile. The first is working in the service of others, so that you're not preoccupied with yourself. And you can always give love and kindness. You can't make other people like you, but if you make it unconditional as a gift to be kind to others, it'll come back sometimes, and that's a bonus. The second is to let go of all fighting and worrying. And that is a key effort that we all need to make to not focus on struggle and striving, but to just kind of let go and have some hope and confidence that life is going to work out if I'm a part of it. Mm. And then the third is to work on growing in awareness so that rather than putting things out of mind that are unpleasant to us, to try to understand them, where they came from, what they lead to, so that we can deal with them more effectively in the future, and also to grow in awareness of our body, to think of our motivations and what's meaningful. And to do that, of course, we have to understand the processes of our thought. And so that's a corollary to the other three.
I wonder if a good personal test wouldn't be to see if you really do feel better when you are giving a gift to someone as opposed to receiving one.
That study's been actually done with very careful brain imaging, and it's fascinating. People were given a bunch of money that they could give away. Now, usually most people find it painful to give away money, but if you give money to a charity that you're highly engaged in and you value, what it does is it doesn't just, instead of depressing the pleasure center, the nucleus accumbens in the lower part of our emotional brain, there's a connection between the prefrontal cortex, in fact, the frontal poles, that because when we give the meaning that we're doing something for other people, it turns out it activates our own reward system. And that's why giving is rewarding. And that's why if a mother sacrifices for her child, she's doing something meaningful, and that is pleasurable.
I want to take another call here because I think Eric has an unusual approach to this. Let's find out for certain. Eric, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. All very interesting. Well, what you're talking about, I actually had a two-part question, but I'll mention the one you're talking about first, which is earlier you mentioned that happiness was the driver of success rather than trying to achieve success and then thinking you'll be happy. That's what was mentioned first, I mean at the earlier part of the program. Mm-hmm. And what about the cases when sadness or depression drives success? And I'm thinking mostly of artists, great artists. Tchaikovsky's greatest symphony, the Pathétique, was written when he was in the depths of depression about a marriage that had just failed. That was one of my questions. And I actually am the artistic type, and I tend to brood a lot. And things come out of that are very good, but it takes a long time. Then my second question is more of a prosaic question, which is I saw a book a few years ago called The Progress Paradox by Greg Easterbrook that said that as things are getting better, people are feeling worse. And he was talking about the period, like say, from 1950 to the present. And I'm wondering if that is indeed the case in the United States with all of our material gain. Are people actually getting worse? Are there reliable studies out there? A reliable measures that say maybe we're actually getting less happy in the United States because of all the stress and the isolation resulting from technology and so forth.
Eric, let's get a response to that. And I think, Tim Bono, you probably want to take that.
Yeah, I think I have more to say to your second question about how the conditions of our lives seem to have be improving, and yet we aren't any happier. If anything, we're probably less happy as a country. If you think about the modern amenities that we now have compared to our parents or our grandparents, we're living pretty well. I think that one useful way to conceptualize happiness is simply as the quotient of what we have as compared to what we want. So mathematically, as the denominator of that formula gets larger, that puts a cap on the overall quotient. So if you think about the last half century, our homes are nicer, we have Wi-Fi, we have all these wonderful things that make life so much easier. But at the same time that our wealth has been increasing and the amenities of our homes, even faster, what's been inflating are the expectations that we have about how wonderful life should be. And so I think that that is largely what is driving what you're describing here, that, yeah, we have more, but we're not as happy because we expect so much more. And that's why I think gratitude has been shown to be such an effective intervention for increasing our happiness, because gratitude effectively shines a spotlight on the numerator of that formula and really prompts us to take a few moments to reflect on the good things that we do have. And when we appreciate those things, we get more out of them. And therefore, that puts a cap on the expectations we have about, well, I don't have what that guy has, or that person has more than me. Gratitude is really emphasizing those things that we do have.
What about the notion of finding success through unhappiness?
Well, let me take the first part of the question then. There are two parts to it. First, even the first question had two parts. Artists do tend to be more reflective and contemplative. And that is a very helpful way of deepening our understanding of what's really meaningful and looking for solutions. And so that's an important pathway to well-being. But if you just want to look at predictors of success and well-being, it turns out that the strongest predictors are self-directedness, a personality trait that involves being resourceful and purposeful. And this, together with cooperativeness, with empathy and kindness and helpfulness, together predict the healthy people who are both successful in life because they can work and love, as Freud would refer to, and they can also maintain positive emotions. These are the strongest predictors of both subjective well-being, social well-being, and physical well-being.
We only have 2 minutes left. We have an emailer here who says, Americans asks if Americans have poor emotional intelligence. Far too many of us are unaware or unwilling to pursue treatment and practices that might help us to arrive at a state of well-being.
We are a generally narcissistic culture that's preoccupied with ourselves, and that's not very healthy because it means that we're highly competitive with one another, so that reduces social capital, and it also makes us very vulnerable to any failure. And that's why we get the differences that we do between Scandinavian countries and ours. It's not just a matter of external supports. It's a matter of solidarity.
We also have an emailer here who writes that she participates in two laughter clubs here in St. Louis. I didn't know there was such a thing. Have you gentlemen heard of it?
Mm-hmm.
And she says it's done wonders for her, and that her feeling of well-being and satisfaction is very much greater. Dan?
I know a number of people who really like doing that sort of thing. That's one of those things where your mileage is going to vary on whether that's something that's going to be worth doing. For some people, it's just not going to fit their values or the way they see themselves or maybe their personality. And I sure hope workplaces don't start requiring employees to do that. And also, relating to the other question, there are other things that matter besides happiness. One of the reasons I didn't choose to be a philosopher just to be happy. And I might have been a little happier doing something else, but part of it is I wanted to do something, contribute certain things.
We're going to have to end there. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Robert Cloninger, thank you. Dan Hayburn, thank you for being with us. And Tim Bono, thank you so much for being with us. Tomorrow on this program, we're going to be talking about the labor movement, past and present. Hope you'll be with us for that. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh. If you
never have a dream.